Way News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It reached a point where it's going to take the world to stop it, and also where, if we don't stop it, it could pose a threat to global health security.
That's Dr. Margaret Harris, Manager of Communication for the WHO's Ebola Response Team in the DRC. Details next. Also, officials say if the fighting does not slow down in the battle for Tripoli, Libya could be headed towards disaster. And former South African President Jacob Zuma is testifying at a corruption inquiry. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the World Health Organization, WHO, announced yesterday the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo now constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. I talked to the manager of communications for the WHO's Ebola response team in the DRC, Dr. Margaret Harris. I started out by asking her to explain the international public health concern regarding the outbreak that has killed 1,700 people and continues to spread at an alarming rate.
It's quite a difficult concept, really. What it really is a wake-up call, putting the world on notice that this is now something we all have to work together on. For us, for WHO, this has been an emergency at the highest level since the beginning, and we graded what we call a grade 3, which means we have to put all our resources, human and otherwise, into working on it. Now it's reached a point where it's going to take the world to stop it, and also where, if we don't stop it, it could pose a threat to global health security. This is not something we do lightly. It is something that is declared under what is known as the International Health Regulations, which are a set of rules that were agreed by all the member states of the World Health Organization in 2005 in the wake of the SARS crisis, when you might remember the SARS virus came to Hong Kong and was spread throughout the world and was a major threat to global health security. So we've only ever done this 4 times. We don't do it lightly, but what it means is that all the member states agree to do what the committee, the emergency committee on the Ebola virus has recommended they do.
What kind of concrete steps have to be taken? I mean, this thing seems to be jumping borders.
Well, this is why the public health emergency of international concern has been declared. It has not yet jumped any borders in a sustained fashion. But our concern is the level of transmission, the geographic spread, the geography over which it is being spread is so large, and other factors like ongoing conflict and really difficulty getting the community to believe that Ebola is real and to trust that the actions being taken to respond to the transmission of the virus are things that the community thinks should be done. These things are making this possibly one of the most difficult Ebola virus outbreak to manage. And so, yes, as you say, there is a threat that it will jump borders. And if it does jump borders, and if it does develop sustained transmission in the town of Goma, that was one of the triggers for considering the need for declaring the public health of emergency of international concern. We had one man, gentleman, a pastor, who traveled down from one of the hotspots, Butembo, down to Goma, and then exhibited very clear symptoms of Ebola and was identified very early. But we are very concerned that he may have seeded transmission in Goma. So we are watching very carefully. We haven't seen any signs of that transmission yet, but we feel it's at that point where we need to ring that warning alarm, warning alarm bell to the world.
Doctor, WHO has the best of intentions, but it has been difficult to get ahead of the outbreak as ongoing violence in the area has impacted response efforts. So how do you go about changing the mindset?
This is really the hardest thing of all, especially when you're dealing with people who have absolutely no reason to trust anyone who seems to come in a position of authority. They have had generations of conflict, and conflict with a whole bunch of different people, whether it be militia bands from a nearby community, whether it be a more organized groups from a neighboring countries, and even their own government is not a government they trust, because this is a hugely opposition area. And in fact, the leader of the opposition, who comes from this particular area, North Kivu, and is very much loved by the people of this area, he has been in exile for, I think, 11 years. He has just returned to the area, and he is in fact working with us to try to persuade the communities that, first of all, Ebola is real. It's not a political myth to somehow disenfranchise them further, and that it is in their interest to work with the response and identify any new cases and ensure that anybody who may have been in contact with the virus is followed up and vaccinated.
And lastly, Doctor, while this outbreak has yet to have the level of global attention that the West African outbreak garnered, where more than 1,100 people died. And that also affects the funding, the pledges.
If it goes to other countries, if it goes far broader, managing, controlling, stopping the virus starts to be an enormously costly thing for the entire world. So once again, we're saying, let's stop it now and support us financially, also technically, with good scientific work, with the right kind of expertise from all over the world. It's not just about money, but it is the time when we all need to work together.
That was Dr. Margaret Harris, Manager of Communications for the WHO Ebola Response Team in the DRC. She was speaking to me from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Cameroon's second largest employer, the Cameroon Development Corporation, says it has been paralyzed by the separatist conflict in the country's English-speaking regions. The agricultural giant has not been able to pay its staff for a year because of falling production and revenue. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Lembe, Cameroon.
The village of Mianja used to be a banana production center in Cameroon's English-speaking southwest. 2 years ago, 2,000 people lived here, and many worked for the Cameroon Development Corporation's banana production unit. But these days, a visiting reporter sees only abandoned houses, empty schools, and silent factories. Oliver Kogge worked at the Mianja banana factory, but says security threats forced them to shut down. Armed separatists attacked the factory in 2017, he says, killing four workers and wounding scores of others.
This particular processing unit produces averagely 60 tons of banana daily. And after this attack, workers ceased. Workers escaped for their dear life. 560 workers were working in this particular section. In the course of stopping work, we have deprived 560 workers from employment.
The Cameroon Development Corporation is the Central African country's second largest employer and runs banana, palm oil and rubber plantations. But the three-year conflict between Anglophone rebels and government troops has forced the CDC to close farms and factories across the Western English-speaking regions. CDC General Manager Franklin Ngoninjie says more than half of his 20,000 workers, fearing attacks, refuse to work, while the remainder work only part-time.
If you look at the economy of our area, what else do we have? CDC every month, directly in form of salaries and wages, is 2.2 billion francs every month. All of that activity is dead.
Cameroon's agriculture minister, Gabriel Mairobi, says the government is negotiating with staff to resume work. He says the government will assure their safety and settle the past year of unpaid salaries.
I would like to appreciate the willingness of all the workers to resume work. I can assure them that the government will take all the measures to pay the salary area and to give money so that the plantation and the factory will be back in activity.
The conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking regions was sparked in 2016 by protests against discrimination from the country's French-speaking majority in education and the justice system. The government responded with a crackdown, and armed separatists fought back. The rebels consider state-run companies such as the CDC and institutions such as schools legitimate targets. Last month, the Cameroon Employers Association said rebel fighters had transformed many CDC plantations into training grounds. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Limbe, Cameroon.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma has spent 3 days testifying at a corruption inquiry that looks into numerous allegations of cronyism and undue influence on state organs during his time in office. But is Zuma bringing answers to light, or is he raising more questions? VOA's Anita Powell has the story from Johannesburg.
South Africa has yet to hear many actual answers from Jacob Zuma on how private interests allegedly influenced government decisions for years, leading to dubious high-level appointments. But what Zuma has provided this week during his testimony at the so-called State Capture Commission is plenty of drama. In 3 days of near-constant talking, the former leader, whose party pressured him to resign last year, has alleged that some top politicians are spies, complained the inquiry is unfair, and said his life is now at risk.
I just thought for record, this commission must know
that
my life and my children, my lawyers, are now under threat.
That was Zuma on Tuesday, on the second day of his testimony in Johannesburg. The Judicial Commission of Inquiry into Allegations of State Capture, Corruption, and Fraud in the Public Sector has now gone on for more than a year and seen dozens of witnesses. At the center of this drama is a wealthy family, the Guptas. The Gupta family is said to have been so close to Zuma that several top politicians testified that the family offered them high-level cabinet positions in exchange for beneficial commercial decisions. The highest-profile Gupta family member fled South Africa shortly after Zuma resigned, and this week, Zuma's lawyer, Thabani Masuku, has argued that the family's absence is a problem.
It's highly unfair. If the Guptas are not going to be here to testify and to corroborate what Mr. Masego has said here, it's just unfair to ask the president to recall or to interpret what role he may have played in the removal of Mr. Masego.
The lawyer was referring to Tembo Maseko, who left his job as a government communications spokesman in 2011 and recently testified on Zuma's close ties to the Gupta family. Maseko was replaced after allegedly refusing to direct government advertising contracts to the Gupta's now-defunct media businesses. Corruption was a central issue during this year's election, and President Cyril Ramaphosa won re-election on an anti-corruption platform. Under Zuma, the nation saw numerous, fruitless anti-corruption inquiries. But Ronald Chauke of the Organization of Undoing Tax Abuse, a South African watchdog, says he hopes things will be different this time, because Ramaphosa has said he will allow the commissions to do their work. Chauke also questions the testimony Zuma has offered this week.
To be honest with you, he was falling short. Basically, it shows you that it's like all of a sudden he remembers things that happened by the 1960s, 40, 50 years ago. But when he has to remember critical things that happened recently in the last 3 years or 4 years, he tends to say that he doesn't remember, he doesn't recall. So basically, he's having a convenient amnesia, of which for me actually is deliberate lying and a deliberate withholding of critical information to the commission.
Zuma is set to testify for one more day on Friday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. In 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The World Health Organization says the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the DRC now constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. Cameroon's second largest employer, the Cameroon Development Corporation, is paralyzed by the separatist conflict in the country's English-speaking regions. And former South African President Jacob Zuma has spent 3 days testifying at the corruption inquiry. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe's fast-rising inflation is eroding workers' income, with raises unable to keep pace. So, the Zimbabwe's Congress of Trade Unions says it will soon call for a stay-away to pressure government to urgently act to deal with the situation. The warning has sparked death threats against union leaders. Reporter Kudzai Zedawash has more details.
Leaders of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions say they have received letters warning them against calling for another stay away. The letters threatened death for them and violence against their families. Each letter was accompanied by a bullet. The union organized the last stay away in January to protest large fuel price hikes. That led to an internet shutdown, human rights violations, and deployment of the military into some of Harare's high-density suburbs. Japhet Moyo is the Secretary General for the union, who has a pending case at the courts for alleged treason in connection with the stairway.
The strategy is to probably harass us, because when you then extend the threat to family members, you then put pressure on us from family members who say, why would you take the risk? To us, these are the hazards of our work. We are not going to be discouraged.
Moyo says they have notified police about the threats, but they will go ahead with planned stay away. He claims the state is behind the threats in what he views as a case of misplaced priorities.
That will not bring cheaper bread. Those threats will not give Zimbabweans money. Those threats are not going to bring medication at our hospitals. This is not what the state is supposed to be focusing on, silencing dissent voices. No, that's not the way to do it.
Government officials best suited to comment on the matter did not respond to requests for comment by airtime. Job cuts, delayed salaries, insufficient raises, and the rising cost of living are some of the words Moyo uses to describe Zimbabwe's labor markets. So he says the labor movement will use a stay away to pressure government to act.
We want it to be as effective as possible. We want everyone to participate. It has taken us time to engage with everyone. I think that's the reason why it has taken us long to announce the proper date in which we want everyone to stay away from work. The dates are going to be announced soon. We have covered much ground.
Moyo says the goal is to completely stay away from work. He adds that the union is aware that similar mass actions have often been characterized by violence carried out by individuals or organizations who have ulterior motives. Moyo advises businesses to close when the stay-away day comes to avoid becoming targets for such violent elements. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
The African Union is working to increase the number of health and science researchers on the continent under a program known as Developing Excellence in Leadership, Training and Science, or Deltas Africa. The AU and British agencies are training 1,500 young researchers. Sarah Kimani has details from Dakar, where student researchers presented some of their work.
In 2007, African heads of state committed to investing at least 1% of their country's gross domestic products, or GDP, to research and development. That goal has remained unmet, in part because of a lack of African researchers. Alphonso Zneba is the deputy director of the Africa Academy of Sciences, based in Nairobi.
The number of researchers on the continent compared to other parts of the world is a drop in the ocean. there's a metric that we use. We see the number of researchers per 1 million of the population. In Africa, that number is less than 200. You can compare that to the UK, for instance, which is about 4,000 per 1 million people.
According to the United Nations, only Malawi has attained the 1% target, while Kenya, South Africa, and Tunisia are above 0.7% of GDP. Foreign funding is now bridging that gap through an initiative dubbed Deltas Africa, funded by the British charity Wellcome Trust and Britain's Department for International Development. Dr. Simon Kay from the Wellcome Trust explains.
And our vision is to create a large cohort of internationally competitive researchers. The Deltas Africa Awards will mean that African institutions will have greater ownership of training scientists and researchers, often in countries where becoming a scientist is still not a recognized career path.
One of the scientists, Mamukwaju Banda from Malawi, has opted to look into the rise of diabetes complications in her country.
I was noticing a lot of people in the wards being admitted because of diabetes, and I realized that there must be something why people are facing complications from diabetes, when we expect that once you're found with diabetes and you're managing yourself well at home, you shouldn't come back to the hospital with complications.
Banda hopes to offer a lasting solution to the problem.
After I'm done with all of this, we're getting into engagement with the people, back giving them back the results, getting back to the nurses and doctors that are working in the hospital to see how best can we move forward from this, having known what exactly most of those people are failing to implement.
The young researchers are being trained at 11 universities and institutions across the continent. About 300 gathered in Dakar this week to present their work to peers, African scientists, and possible future benefactors. The program began in 2015 and is due to run through next year. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Dakar.
And in the world of sports, the Africa Cup of Nations soccer tournament, AFCON, comes to an end tomorrow when Senegal plays Algeria in the final. Both teams emerged from Group C in the tournament hosted by Egypt. Algeria has been dominant in AFCON with 5 wins and a draw while outscoring their opponents 12-2. They defeated Senegal 1-0 in group play. They are seeking their first AFCON title since 1990, while Senegal has never won and only reached the final once before. Stay tuned for more details on the sunny side of sports. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.